Thank you. Please be seated. Court is ready to hear argument from petitioners in Haas versus Glasgow.
May it please the court, counsel. Although the Honorable Texarkana Court of Appeals correctly ruled, among other things, that certain letters that were written by Mr. Glazner, the respondent in this case, and signed by Mr. Hossie, my client, the petitioner, did not constitute a contract and did not satisfy the statute of frauds, the court erred in other respects, holding that Mr. Glazner could continue to seek his contract damages or a benefit of the bargain damages by asserting claims of fraud and fraudulent inducement. The error occurred in three respects. First, the Court of Appeals failed to distinguish between a tort of fraud and a tort of fraudulent inducement by failing to require allegations and proof of an independent damage to the plaintiff in a fraud claim, which are not required in a fraudulent inducement claim, according to this Court's decision in Formosa. The Court of Appeals also erred in holding that Glazner could assert a fraudulent inducement claim without there being a contract, in the absence of a binding contract.
So are you saying there is a fraud claim, just not a fraudulent inducement claim?
Your Honor, what I'm saying, in this particular case, there was no independent allegations of fraud. There was only, although the word fraud was used in this case, in the pleadings, in the underlying pleadings, the plaintiff stated common law and statutory fraud. Those were his allegations of fraud. And
I'm not sure I understand. Are you saying we decided based on the pleadings, or?
Well, partially based on the pleadings in this case. That's what the appellate court failed to look at. Is what one part of this. The pleadings in this case simply stated there was common law and statutory fraud. That was the only allegation of fraud in this case, other than a vague claim of fraudulent inducement.
I thought the pleadings, though, although they didn't state what they were, listed at least five different theories of fraud: promise of future employment, a statement of opinion known to be false, false statements of fact, statement of opinion based on false statements, and an expression of opinion that is false by one claiming special knowledge. Those are all different theories of fraud, you agree that there's more than one species of fraud.
I certainly agree, Your Honor. Okay. There's more than one species of fraud. The question, though, that was presented was what the trial court ordered the plaintiff in this case to say, okay, here are these theories. What are your factual allegations with respect to fraud? What are the allegations, and what are your damages with respect to your fraud claim? And the plaintiff failed to replead.
But you didn't move for summary judgment on that basis. With respect to fraud, you only moved that the plaintiff's fraud claims are barred by the statute of frauds with respect to fraud. That's the only ground I see in your motion.
Well, Your Honor, if that's the only pleading that we had to work with.
But you didn't file a no-evidence summary judgment motion. You filed a regular summary judgment motion and offered proof to the trial court.
We offered proof to the trial court that there was no fraud, as best we could, because there was no pleadings.
I understand, but I'm just trying to get the procedural framework of this. I see a pleading that has several different species. Special exceptions were granted, ordering the plaintiff to replead. Plaintiff didn't replead, but you only moved for summary judgment with respect to the fraud claim on the grounds that the fraud claims are barred by the statute of frauds.
Right, because the only ones that were pled were barred by the statute of frauds.
Well, what about the misrepresentation of fact?
Your Honor,
are fraud claims based on misrepresentation of fact made with reckless disregard and that are detrimentally relied upon by a person?
They could be, but there are no specific statements that amount to that.
No, I understand that you're saying that that's the case, that there's not any, but I'm just trying to get a handle on procedurally where we are, since we've got a summary judgment proceeding here that we've got to stick to the rules by.
Your Honor, and I agree with you,
tell me how I get there with you in the face of those pleadings and a summary judgment motion that only relies upon the statute of frauds as a ground for granting summary judgment against the plaintiff on the fraud claim.
Well, with respect to the fraud claim, Your Honor, I believe that there is a requirement under Friesen Hahn case that a summary judgment can be based on the fact that the plaintiff failed to comply with the court's order to special to.
But don't you have to base your summary judgment motion on that? Don't you have to say, as a ground of summary judgment, this is the reason why I'm entitled to summary judgment, and you didn't do that?
Well, Your Honor,
so
I don't.
What do we do with that?
Well, I don't think you have to, because I think under that scenario, if you said there are no pleadings, there are no factual allegations, there's nothing, there's no, and the court says you've got to put forth some factual allegations and put forth some damages, there's no way you can respond to that, other than to say that the pleadings, that there is no, you can offer your proof that you have in response to any claims of fraud, but there's no way that you can respond to every conceivable claim and rebut every conceivable.
Can't you move? Isn't that the purpose of a no evidence summary judgment motion?
Well, I think no evidence deals with a different factor. No evidence is, there's no evidence of these claims, but these claims are not even pled in terms of factual allegations. You don't need to go through.
Then don't you either need to move for summary judgment or move to dismiss based on the pleadings and the failure to replead as a ground for dismissal?
Well, Your Honor, I think you can move based on the pleadings as they stand, and the court can use that interpretation of the pleadings. If the party did not plead factual allegations that support its claims, I think that the court can just disregard those claims.
Did Glasner plead for damages other than contract damages, or damages that would be measured by a breach of contract?
There was no pleading other than for contract damages or for breach of contract damages. And that's part of that was also part of this request to the trial court, that they set forth any other damages that they might have.
Was there testimony in the summary judgment record of other damages aside from contract damages?
There is no testimony of any other damages outside of contract damages. And in fact, the testimony I've cited, I believe, the respondents stated that all he was seeking was lost profits or contract damages.
Wasn't there evidence of damages that were in response to reliance on representations made by your client? I thought that there was.
I don't believe that there was any evidence of any damages in that regard.
Isn't there? Well, what? There's a reference to a contract to buy some property. There's no evidence of some sort of down payment being made.
Your Honor, I believe what happened in that particular case and what the evidence was that that there was a down payment made and it was returned to this gentleman. In other words, that when he didn't buy the property, the down payment was returned to him, and that he did not suffer any damages as a result of that. I believe that was the underlying testimony in the case. I don't believe there was any finding or any claim that he lost money because of that.
Okay, I've got two things here. It says that plaintiff claims he contracted for an option to purchase land on which he intended to open a Whataburger franchise. Is that correct?
Was
that
right, and I believe that's where the money was returned to him.
And then there's also a claim that he capitalized on his efforts, that your client capitalized on Glasner's efforts regarding demographics and potential profits and location, all the work that you would do in preliminary to obtaining a franchise. Was that in the record?
Well, Your Honor, if you'll recall, in the underlying case, there was a claim made by Mr. Glasner for unjust enrichment and for quantum merit, which we believe those would fall into. That claim was made, and the appellate court dealt with that and said, in the underlying case, so that is not an issue in this matter. Now, I don't believe that there's any evidence that he was out of pocket any expenses as a result of that. He was maybe out of pocket some time if his allegations were correct, but at the same time, he was an employee and was working my client at that time. So. But the appellate court, in what has not been appealed to this court by Glasner, dealt with that issue and found that there was no unjust enrichment or no quantum merit, no merit to those claims. With respect to that first error that we discussed, that is the failing to distinguish between the fraud and fraudulent inducement claims, the court found that the legal duty that they found, if you look at their opinion, the appellate court found the duty was that was alleged by Glazner was, quote, the use of fraud to induce another into executing a contract. This, of course, is fraudulent inducement. As the respondent correctly points out in his brief, you must allege a material misrepresentation that induced the party to do something and have damages resulting from that inducement in order to have a claim of fraud. As we pointed out earlier in his petition, Glazner failed to plead any facts supporting any of these elements and did not even identify any claimed misrepresentations. The only evidence that Glazner offered, as we just discussed, was evidence that he lost the benefit of the bargain in this particular case. He didn't offer any evidence of any other damages.
Why would he have to do that if he didn't move for summary judgment on the ground that he had no compensable damages under the law? I mean, why would he be required to offer controverting proof with respect to the kind of damage he was claiming if you didn't move for summary judgment on that basis?
Well, Your Honor, we did move for summary judgment on the basis of there not being a fraud claim. And in order to prove fraud outside...
We moved on the basis that it was barred by the statute of frauds.
Right. Because there is no proof of any damages other than benefit of bargain damages. There was no pleading of it and no proof of it. So you have to tie the two together. The only damages that were alleged or offered any proof of was the loss of profits or the contract
damages. But that's dependent on whether or not the only fraud claim he asserted was a fraudulent inducement claim.
Well, that... And that's our position.
I know that's your position, but if in fact there was another fraud claim based on a different theory than fraudulent inducement, then that argument doesn't hold up.
I believe that would be correct, Your Honor.
Do you, I guess I'm a little bit confused. Do you assert that only the fraudulent inducement claim is disposed of by the statute of frauds?
Well, Your Honor, I guess it depends on how the court views it. I think there's two ways to look at this. One is, and I think the easier way probably is to analyze a claim based on whether a party is asserting contract damages and has a contract. With respect to fraudulent inducement claims, the very nature of that claim, it requires there to be a contract that was entered into between the parties. Without a binding contract, there can't be detrimental reliance, there can't have been any damage. In every case that we've located and all the cases that have been cited where fraudulent inducement was upheld, there's always been a contract.
Well, the issue, maybe I'm not making myself clear, the question of the statute of frauds is that you do not have a binding contract.
Correct.
And it seems to me the cases say that you can't use fraud as an indirect way to accomplish what you couldn't do directly, which is to enforce a contract that's contrary to the statute of frauds. Now, I understood you in answer to the earlier question to say, no, the statute of frauds defense only applies to fraud and the inducement. So then my question is, so what is your claim that fraud doesn't apply?
Well, Your Honor, I think fraudulent, the fraud claim, if by a fraud claim you are seeking benefit of the bargain damages, if that's what you are seeking by virtue of your fraud claim, however you would characterize that the statute of limitations would apply in that particular scenario.
In the statute of frauds?
The statute of frauds, I'm sorry, would apply in that particular scenario. It depends, I believe, on the damages that are being sought, because it's a situation where the policy of both the legislature and I think the legislature in codifying the statute of frauds was based on common law. If you cannot prove your damages by contract, if it's so ambiguous, if the terms are so vague, all the things that, in fact, the appellate court found in this case, if you can't prove the benefit of the bargain, then you shouldn't be able to, in order to satisfy a contract claim, you shouldn't be able to try to prove the benefit of the bargain by alleging a fraud claim. So it kind of depends on how you look at it. They're two sides of the same coin, I believe. That is, whether there is a contract or not, that's an easy way to deal with it. Whether they're seeking benefit of the bargain damages is the true test of whether they're really setting forth a fraud claim or not setting forth a fraud claim.
Any other questions? Thank you.
Thank you.
May it please the court, Mr. John Mercy will present argument for the respondent.
May it please the court. Good morning. This case, I think, is illustrative of an opportunity that the defendant sees to take a decision by this court that was fairly clear and extend it to where this court never intended it to go. Formosa Plastics dealt with these very arguments. The only difference between this case and the Formosa Plastics case with regard to the fraud and fraudulent inducement issues is the fact there's no written or binding oral contract in the end. Justice Hankinson is correct. The summary judgment in this case on the fraud claims was a, for lack of a better term, an old-fashioned summary judgment, not a no-evidence summary judgment. It's interesting to note that they did move on our equitable claims on the basis that we didn't state a cause of action there, and the Court of Appeals upheld that. They didn't do that with regard to the fraud claims. What they're trying to do is resurrect the argument that this court first addressed in Graham versus Roeder over 180 years ago, which is the economic loss rule, which is the argument that if the damages are the same for the contract as they are for the fraud, then you're not entitled to recover.
What damages, other than benefit of bargain or breach of contract damages, are you seeing?
Interestingly, here there are some additional damages. I can list them by category, probably is the best way to do it. He has damages from the preparation and the obtaining of the lease on the particular piece of property, including the payment of surveyor's fees in obtaining a survey. He also submitted loan applications to the SBA in anticipation of this deal going through. Those are in the record.
And that's our, you're seeking the out-of-pocket?
In addition to the benefit of the bargain.
Both of these, though, are out-of-pocket.
Yes, sir.
Your
Honor, that's not in the record.
What damages are you claiming in connection with the submission of the loan?
For preparation of
it. Preparation of it.
Yes, sir. But this is a case where...
Any other out-of-pocket damages?
No, ma'am, not that are in the record. And what you have to keep in mind is at the stage where the summary judgment was filed in this case, basically there are the depositions of the two parties. There is a controverting affidavit filed by Mr. Glazner, which does address these, but it's not as specific on damages, because at that time the argument wasn't that the economic loss rule might bar us from it. The argument was...
Are the benefit of bargain damages foreclosed by the... statute of frauds?
No, Your Honor. I don't believe so based on this court's holding in Formosa. Whether it is a fraudulent inducement claim or whether it's a regular fraud claim, this court addressed exactly that same issue, and not once but twice in the opinion makes the same statement, which I think is very interesting because typically this court doesn't repeat itself in an opinion unless it means to emphasize it. But it says that the fraud claim can be based on a promise made with no intention of performing, irrespective of whether the promise is later subsumed within a contract. Subsumed within the contract.
What's the benefit, then, of the statute of frauds here if the plaintiff is allowed to pursue the same benefit of the bargain damages that would be available in a breach of contract case, which is not available here if the statute of frauds argument of the defendant is right?
This court has held that there's an independent duty, essentially a duty of honesty, which is what raises, separate and apart from the contract, this duty is to not make misrepresentations in attempting to obtain the contract.
So mostly they had, the claim was the contractor entered into the subcontract, basically, under false impressions, and he was contractually bound to perform, and he wouldn't have entered into that contract and wouldn't have gone, made all those outlays but for the fraud. Correct. So it's a different situation.
Because there is a contract. The problem we have here is my client is ready, willing, able, making preparation to enter into the contract. Just before it's subsumed into a contract, the other side backs out. They know they were going to back out from the beginning. And then takes advantage of the preparation and the work that my client did in moving toward that contract.
But under traditional fraud damages, you're only out-of-pocket or benefit of the bargain.
I'm sorry?
Traditional fraud damages are only out-of-pocket or benefit of the bargain.
Correct.
And you had no bargain that was enforceable.
We had the potential for a bargain. If we can, and this is a proof problem we may have when it goes back. At summary judgment, though, I don't think the court was right in booting us out, A, because it wasn't raised, and B, because they didn't disprove it, which they would have been required to under a traditional summary judgment motion. It may be a proof problem when we get back to the trial court as to what the amount of that is.
If we had all the Texas law prior to Formosa, would you have a claim for benefit of the bargain damages?
On which claim? Because
if the Formosa case wasn't there, would you have any other authority to get benefit of the bargain as opposed to out-of-pocket damages?
Sure, Your Honor. And Formosa actually lists the cases going back, like I said, as far as Graham versus Roeder, coming forward talking about the economic loss rule and how it applies to fraud cases. So, yes, I think even if Formosa wasn't there, we would have our claim. The good thing is Formosa's there, and this court did a very good job of reviewing the law and basically setting out what appears to be a fairly bright line rule with regard to fraud cases.
Is Formosa broader than simply referring to fraud in the inducement as opposed to fraud generally?
That's a good question, and if you read it, it specifically talks about fraud in the inducement. I think that is primary. I think the logic and reasoning can be applied to fraud cases. The reason it's limited, I think, is because the facts in that case, it was a fraudulent inducement.
If fraud in the inducement is limited only to cases where a contract was entered into, and fraud covers those circumstances where no contract was entered into, then does that play into a more some clarification of how the statute of frauds affects certain causes of action and doesn't affect others? In other words, if you've got the contract and you're induced into doing something that you would otherwise not agree to, that's one issue. If you don't get the contract, then fraud's out there to protect you if you've changed your positions, except that if the statute of frauds says you can't enforce the contract unless it's in writing, you can't use fraud to get the damages that the contract would have otherwise entitled you to. But you could still get the out-of-pocket expenses up to the point that the contract is attempted to be entered into.
I agree with you up till almost at the end. I think that you're right. Fraudulent inducement is there to protect you if you entered into a contract. Fraud is there to protect you if at the last minute they jerk the contract out from under you. I don't agree that we wouldn't be entitled to whatever we could show our loss was if it was the benefit of the bargain under a fraud theory. I think that we would be entitled to attempt to prove that. Now, whether those damages are capable of being proved or not is a difficult question based on the facts in each case.
If they had made an oral contract with you mm-hmm. instead of no contract at all, you'd be barred?
No. Under a fraudulent inducement theory, it doesn't have to be a written contract. It can be it has to be a binding contract, either oral or written. Now,
so they make a binding contract and breach it. There's nothing left of the statute of frauds, is there? Unless
sure.
You make a contract without any prior negotiations or attempt to the other party to try to get you to get into the contract.
Well, what the policy is to promote honesty in negotiations.
Yeah, but if you don't have a binding contract, if an oral agreement is barred by the statute of frauds.
Correct.
So if
then
that's the case,
fraud.
Then you don't have a fraudulent inducement claim because, in fact, it is barred by the statute. You agree with that?
Yes, Your Honor.
So, in fact, what you're left with is a fraudulent misrepresentation question, and the question, I mean, basic fraud.
A fraud
case. Misrepresentation, and the question is what damages can you recover?
Correct.
Okay.
And part of the what you're struggling with is because the way this case was postured when it was tried, or when it was pled, actually, was we anticipated there being a contract.
But
we thought
the statute of frauds prevention from proving the bargain. So therefore, you can't prove benefit of the bargain damages because the statute won't let you prove up the bargain.
The statute won't let us recover under a contract theory for the benefit of the bargain.
It won't let you prove up the bargain. It will not let you prove up the oral agreement.
Correct. But that doesn't, I mean, what you have to keep in mind is this court has held, like I said, since going back as far as Graham versus Rutter, that if you can prove it, you could prove up your economic damages, which can include the benefit of the bargain. Now, like I said, it may be a proof problem at trial.
Well, let's give an example. Justice Hutchinson and I have an oral agreement. I'm going to buy her home, and she doesn't know that I've got a seller ready, willing, able to pay me a lot more for that house as soon as I buy it from her and I can resell it. That oral contract is unenforceable. She backs out. I sue her for the lost profit I would have made on that transaction. Now, am I precluded by the statute of frauds, or can I recover under a fraud theory for those damages?
You probably can't under the scenario you've given, because there's not going to be, you probably don't have fraud. Simple fact that she backed out.
She promised me she wouldn't. She was right. She promised me she would sign on the dotted line. We show up and she doesn't close.
I've
made preparations. I've had attorney's fees. I've done the survey.
If you can meet your burden of proof, you could recover that if you can show that her fraud caused you to lose a sale that you would have had. Your situation, where if you had an option contract or something, may even be stronger. A better situation is you want to build a house, but you don't have any clue what you want in it, so you engage a contractor to draw up plans for you and show you how to do all of this stuff, and he goes through all this. You have no intention of having him build the house. He goes through all the effort. He designs your house. He designs around problems. He designs the interior. And then you back out, which you meant to do from the beginning. Now, is he entitled to recover the benefit of that bargain?
Do you keep his plans or ever look at them?
Yeah, if you use his plans in your new house. Yeah, that situation, you can show that he has lost the benefit of that bargain your fraud.
Does he get his out-of-pocket, or does he also get the profit he would have made had he built your house?
He can get either one. And he's put basically to an option of which one he wants to recover. See, so it becomes really a proof problem as to whether or not he can do it. In my scenario, I think it's very, very clear that there is causative effect.
But
I'm sorry.
Go ahead.
I was just going to say, where's the statute of frauds?
Right. The statute of frauds is not just about honesty, but about encouraging people to put these sorts of agreements in writing. I mean, it sort of eliminates some of the proof problems.
But what you're taking is a defense to a contract action and attempting to apply it to a tort by moving it from whether or not the contract is binding to posture whether it is a defense to a fraud action, to your misrepresentations. And if you do that, you can never have fraud unless you put it in writing, which is one of the problems that you run into when you're trying to switch the defense.
Well, you could have fraud, but you just would be limited to non-contract damages, out-of-pocket expenses. You wouldn't get the benefit of the bargain, which is what the statute of frauds is all about.
But if you apply it as they're asking you, you don't do away with the damages. You do away with the fraud.
You get reliance damages, don't you?
If it's potential that you could, which would limit you to out-of-pocket.
But, I mean, if you went working on something else, that period of time, that may not be benefit of the bargain. That may be relying out of pocket
and
as well.
And what you're talking about are proof problems with the damages, not whether you can recover, but whether you can prove those damages to recover them. You know, in my contractor scenario,
isn't that what this case is about?
To a great extent, yes. Because
there's an argument As I understand it, petitioner says you're not entitled to out-of-pocket, but it's not because, theoretically, you're not. It's a proof and pleading problem.
If that's how it was postured when it got to this court, you might have an argument, but that's not how the case is postured before this court right now.
Mr. Mercy, what in looking at the pleadings and looking to the response to the summary judgment, it appears that Mr. Glasner has focused on what he really wants is the Whataburger stand. It is not clear that he has sought any claim for out-of-pocket expenses. Where is the posture of the summary judgment on that? Is there a claim in the pleadings, in the response for an identified out-of-pocket expenses, or is the Court of Appeals just sending it back because we just don't know what's being claimed?
There is not a specified amount in the pleadings.
Is there a specified claim for out-of-pocket?
Not by that name. I think it is incorporated into the prayer in the First Amendment complaint, sufficient that they can recover. That's not really the question, whether our pleadings were sufficient at this point to entitle us to that recovery or not.
If the pleadings say, here's my series of causes of action, and the damages I claim are benefit of the bargain, and the summary judgment says you can't get fraud under that claim, and the trial court, I guess, grants it, and it goes to the Court of Appeals, can the Court of Appeals reverse the summary judgment for having failed to dispose of a fraud claim that would be for out-of-pocket expenses? I'm not sure
what the question is, Your Honor.
If the claim is for benefit of the bargain and the allegation is fraud and the summary judgment is you can't get a fraud claim here, then the trial court grants it and it goes to the Court of Appeals, is the summary judgment sufficient to have disposed of the claims in the trial court, or did the summary judgment is the summary judgment deficient because there is a fraud claim that's recognized for out-of-pocket expenses?
There's a viable claim that wouldn't have been disposed of by the summary judgment the way that it was brought up under your scenario, which is our case. Except
because
our case is a little bit...
It could have, the claim below could have included out-of-pocket,
correct,
even though that's not what was pled for.
Correct. And one of the things that makes this case a little bit more difficult is the granting of the special exceptions requiring us to replead. Counsel at trial decided that he thought his pleadings were sufficient and stood on them, and they never challenged that. So you have pleadings before you that I think are sufficient, particularly on the fraud claim, questionably on the fraudulent inducement claim. But that's one of the problems with the case as it comes up. But if you take the expansive reading and apply the statute of frauds to fraud claims and to fraudulent inducement claims, you in essence will do away with them, because you no longer will have an independent duty to be honest unless you finally end up in a contract.
Well, let me ask you a question. Why I don't understand the connection between benefit of the bargain, which implies an agreement, and a fraudulent misrepresentation claim in which the damages are measured by reliance, the actual amount of the detrimental reliance. By definition, that's what we look to. If I make a fraudulent misrepresentation to you and all the other elements of liability are proved, your damage is the amount that you detrimentally relied. You and I have no bargain because we have no contract. Why would benefit of the bargain damages be recoverable then, as opposed to an amount measured by the amount of your actual reliance on my representation?
And it may be the loose use of the term benefit of the bargain. What you really are entitled to recover are economic losses or out-of-pocket. If you can prove that the benefit of the bargain is part of your economic loss,
but don't you have to prove it's part of your detrimental reliance?
It has to be caused by your detrimental reliance, correct? Remember, we've switched.
Well, I understand, but if that's the case, then I'm a little bit confused about how benefit of the bargain then becomes part of your reliance damage. In other words, reliance, and typically you look at the case law interpreting what reliance means, that I did something or failed to do something as a result of your misrepresentation, and that resulted in some damage that I can identify as a result of the action I took or failed to take. How do you fit benefit of the bargain into that construct?
It may be a proof problem. In this scenario, I think it is. To be honest with this court, I think we have a serious proof problem with the benefit of the bargain damages, ultimately. At this point, though...
Can you think of a scenario where it would fit within the construct of detrimental reliance?
My contractor scenario is the closest one I can come to.
Why would the contractor who didn't build this project get the benefit of those lost profits? I can see all the time you're out and your staff salary and overhead and all that, and maybe whatever, the profit you lost on the other job that you can show that you would have done, but why do you get these profits? Just because they never intended to let you have them,
because,
an opportunity to have them.
Because your reliance on them entering into this contract has put you in a posture where you've lost, theoretically, the ability to build another house during that time period.
But I already said that. That's your out-of-pocket law. What your lost opportunity may.
Right, but your economic loss could be the loss of this profit, and it's going to be fairly factually intensive to get to that.
Really,
that's the closest I can come to a scenario where you can get it. That's why I say it may be a proof problem.
So Frank Gilmore may have been wrong.
Possibly.
Any other questions? Thank you.
Thank you.
Your Honor, first let me address that last question. I think the scenario that was described by counsel with regard to the architect or contractor situation is a classic quantum merit or unjust enrichment claim and not a claim
under
fraud.
Well, it could also be a fraud claim. Would you agree in that instance that the reliance damages would include the amount that he was out for all the work that he did to produce the plans, plus any other missed opportunity he had to take another job while he was working on this project for the person who made the misrepresentation? That would be all his reliance damage.
Certainly he could prove reliance damages.
But would those kinds of things be his reliance damages?
Certainly, but not the benefit of the bargain damages.
I understand, but he could use, in other words, he could recover the amount he may have gotten for doing another job, but just not the amount he would have gotten had he constructed this job.
Well, I'm not sure about the amount of doing another job. I think
he relied on the representation he was going to get to build this house, and so when I walked up and said, "Will you build my house?" he said, "No, because I already have another job."
Well, he failed
to take that job.
That possibly could be a measure he could recover. I think the problem here we're dealing with is that the only thing that was pled in this case was benefit of the bargain damages.
Did you prove conclusively, and I understand your argument about the pleading, but did you prove conclusively that he didn't have out-of-pocket expenses here?
Your Honor, I think there was no proof offered of any out-of-pocket expenses. I think the problem we face here...
Yeah, but did you prove conclusively that there were no out-of-pocket expenses that he suffered in detrimental reliance on?
I think we did, because we asked him the question, what damages do you have? And he said, lost profits are my damages. Do you have any other out-of-pocket expenses? And the answer was no.
Yeah.
And now he mentioned that he filed a loan application. He took some action, but he had no expenses that he was asserting as a result of that.
Now, the pleadings don't specifically pray for benefit of the bargain or out-of-pocket. They just plead for an amount that's within the jurisdictional limits of the court. That's at least the way I read them, or is there something else I should be looking for?
Your Honor, I may be mistaken in that regard as far as whether they actually asked.
You specially accepted on that basis, and your special exception was granted, but the pleading that was on file at the time you filed your summary judgment motion didn't specify the measure of damages.
I think the point is that we, I think it's improper to put a burden on the defendant in a case like this to move for summary judgment on something that he can't know about. We can't know if they're claiming out-of-pocket expenses.
I thought that's what a no-evidence summary judgment motion was to allow you to shift that burden to the other side.
It is if it's pled, but if it's not pled, there's no way to know. You have to bring it up in summary judgment motion. I think the point with regard to the benefit of the bargain issue here is that Formosa clearly stated, and we don't disagree with the proposition that in a fraudulent inducement scenario that you don't have to prove independent injury or damages. We don't disagree with that. What Formosa did not do was address at all the issue of statute of frauds. Had nothing to do with statute of frauds.
Let me ask you about the statute of frauds real quick. Isn't there an exception if there has been detrimental reliance? Doesn't that take you out of statute of frauds?
Your Honor, if it's pled. And Mr.
And isn't that a problem here that we're grappling with? I mean, if detrimental reliance was pled, you wouldn't have a statute of frauds problem. We wouldn't be talking about all these.
Right. If you can prove that you took substantial steps toward the contract, there is an exception to the statute of frauds. It must be pled in the face of the statute of frauds. Must be pled by the other party, and it was not pled in this case.
If detrimental reliance were pled, and you didn't have the statute of frauds problem, then you could recover benefit of the bargain damages.
I think certainly you could recover benefit of the bargain damages
so
in that scenario.
If you don't then rise to the level of detrimental reliance to get you out of the statute of frauds, I presume your argument is you shouldn't be able to recover that contractual measure of damages.
Exactly. Your Honor, I think the point has been well made, and the court is well aware that essentially what would happen if the respondent's arguments were to be adopted by this court, it would be the end of the statute of frauds. And I don't think that all the plaintiff would have to do would be allege, make an allegation, a bald allegation of fraud in order to get around the statute of fraud. I don't think the court wants that to happen. Thank you.
Thank you. That concludes argument in the second clause. The court will take another recess.
All rise.